Chapter 2 Dragon bolts streaked overhead. Below, the ranks of the cataphracts hunched behind their barricade. The horses, held in the rear by younger infantrymen, whinnied with terror and fought their holders. They were useless now, as Belisarius had known they would be. It was for that very reason that he had ordered the cataphracts to dismount and fight afoot, from behind a barricade built by their own aristocratic hands. The armored lancers and archers, once feared by all the world, had not even complained, but had obeyed instantly. Even the noble cataphracts had finally learned wisdom, though the learning had come much too late. What use was a mounted charge against— Over the barricade, the general saw the first of the iron elephants advancing slowly down the Messae, the great central thoroughfare of Constantinople. Behind, he could see the flames of the burning city and hear the screams of the populace. The butchery of the great city's 500,000 inhabitants was well underway now. The Malwa emperor himself had decreed Constantinople's sentence, and the Mahaveda priests had blessed it. Not since Ranipur had that sentence been pronounced. All that lived in the city were to be slaughtered down to the cats and dogs. All save the women of the nobility, who were to be turned over to the Yetai for defilement. Those women who survived would be passed on to the Rajputs. At Ranipur, the Rajputs had coldly declined. But that was long ago, and the name of Rajputana had still carried its ancient legacy. They would not decline now, for they had been broken to their place. The handful who survived the Rajputs would be sold to whatever polluted untouchable could scrape up the coins to buy himself a hag. There would be few untouchables who could afford the price, but there would be some among the teeming multitude of that ever-growing class. The iron elephant huffed its steamy breath, wheezing and gasping. Had it truly been an animal, Belisarius might have hoped it was dying, so horribly wrong was the sound of the creature's respiration. But it was no creature, Belisarius knew. It was a creation, a construct made of human craft and inhuman lore. Still, watching the monstrous thing creeping its slow way forward, surrounded by Yetai warriors howling with glee at their anticipated final triumph, the general found it impossible to think of it as anything other than a demonic beast. Belisarius, seeing one of the cataphracts take up a captured thunder flask, bellowed a command. The cataphract subsided. They possessed few of the infernal devices, and Belisarius was determined to make good use of them. The range was still too great. He stroked his gray beard. Of his youth, nothing remained save whimsy. It amused him to see how old habits never die. Even now, when all hope had vanished from the mind of the general, the heart of the man still beat as strongly as ever. It wasn't a warrior's heart. Belisarius had never truly been a warrior, not at least in the sense that others gave the name. No, he was of unpretentious Thracian stock, and at bottom his was the soul of a workman at his trade. True, he had been supreme in battle. Not war, in the end, for the long war was almost over, the defeat total. Even his most bitter enemies recognized his unchallenged mastery on the field of carnage, as the display of force coming down the Messae attested. Why else mass such an enormous army to overcome such a tiny guard? Had any other man but Belisarius commanded the emperor's last bodyguard, the Mahaveda would have sent a mere detachment. Yes, he had been supreme on the battlefield, but his supremacy had stemmed from craftsmanship, not martial valor. Of the courage of Belisarius no man doubted, not even he. But courage, he had long known, was a common trait. God's most democratic gift, given to men and women of all ages and races and stations in life. Much rarer was craftsmanship, that odd quality which is not satisfied merely with the result sought, but that the work itself be done skillfully. His life was at an end now, but he would end it with supreme craftsmanship, and in so doing, gut the enemy's triumph of its glee. A cataphract hissed. Belisarius glanced over, thinking the man had been hit by one of the many arrows which were now falling upon them. But the lancer was unharmed, his eyes fixed forward. Belisarius followed the eyes and understood. The Mojave, the priest, had appeared now, safely behind the ranks of the Yetai and the Malwa Kshatriyas manning the Iron Elephant. They were drawn forward on three great carts hauled by slaves, each cart bearing three priests and a Mahami Mamsa torturer. From the center of each cart arose a wooden gibbet, and from the gibbets hung the new talismans which they had added to their demonic paraphernalia. There, suspended three abreast, hung those who had been dearest to Belisarius in life. Sittus, his oldest and best friend, Phocius, his beloved stepson, Antonina, his wife. Their skins, rather, flayed from their bodies by the Mahami Mamsa, sewn into sacks which bellied in the breeze, and smeared with the excrement of dogs. The skin sacks had been cleverly designed so that they channeled the wind into a wail of horror. The skins hung suspended by the hair of those who had once filled them in life. The priests took great care to hold them in such a manner that Belisarius could see their faces. The general almost laughed with triumph, but his face remained calm, his expression still. Even now, the enemy did not understand him. He spit on the ground, saw his men note the gesture and take heart, as he had known they would. But even had they not been watching, he would have done the same. What cared he for these trophies? Was he a pagan to mistake the soul for its sheath? Was he a savage to feel his heart break and his bowels loosen at the sight of fetishes? His enemies had thought so, arrogant as always, as he had known they would and planned for. Then he did laugh, and saw his men take note and heart, but he would have laughed anyway. But now that the procession had drawn nearer, he could see that the skin of Sittus was suspended by a cord. "Look there, cataphracts," he cried. "They couldn't hang Sittus by his hair. He had no hair at the end. Lost it all, he did, fretting the night away, devising the stratagems which made them howl." The cataphracts took up the cry. "Antioch! Antioch!" There, the city fallen, Sittus had butchered the Malwa hordes before leading the entire garrison in a successful withdrawal. "Carcos! Carcos!" There, on the Cilician coast, not a month later, Sittus had turned on the host which pursued him. Turned, trapped them, and made the Mediterranean a Homeric sea in truth. Wine dark from Yetai blood. "Pisidie! Pisidie!" There was no wine dark lake in Homer, but had the poet lived to see the havoc which Sittus wreaked upon the Rajputs by the bank of Pisidie's largest lake, he would have sung of it. "Akroinom! Akroinom! Bursa! Bursa!" At Bursa, Sittus had met his death, but not at the hands of the Mahami Mamsa's vivisectors. He had died in full armor, leading the last charge of his remaining cataphracts after conducting the most brilliant fighting retreat since Xenophon's march to the sea. "Then look at the face of Phocius," shouted Belisarius. "Is it not a marvel how well the flayers preserved it? Look, cataphracts, look! Is that not the grin of Phocius, his merry smile?" The cataphracts looked and nodded and took up the cry. "So did he laugh at Alexandria," cried one. "Then he transfixed Achshunwar's throat with his arrow." The Yetai commander of the siege had disbelieved the tales of the garrison leader's archery. He had come to the walls of Alexandria himself to see and scoff and deride the courage of his warriors. But his warriors had been right after all. New cries were taken up by the cataphracts, recalling other feats of Phocius during his heroic defense of Alexandria. Phocius the Fearless, as he had been called. Phocius the beloved stepson, who, when his capture was inevitable, had taken a poison so horrible that it had caused his face to freeze into an eternal rictus. Belisarius had wondered when he heard the tale why his sensible son had not simply opened his veins. But now he understood. From beyond the grave, Phocius sent him a last gift. The best Belisarius saved for last. "And look, look, cataphracts, at the skin of Antonina. Look at the withered, diseased, ruptured thing. They have dug her up from the grave where the plague sent her. How many of the torturers will die, do you think, from that desecration? How many will writhe in agony and shriek to see their bodies blacken and swell? How many? How many? Thousand! Thousands! Roared the cataphracts. Belisarius gauged the moment and thought it good. He scanned the cataphracts and saw that they were with him. They knew his plan and had said they would follow, even though it was an act of personal grace which would bring death to them all. He needed only now a battle cry. He found it at once. Through all the years he had loved Antonina, there was a name he had never called her. Others had, many others, even she herself, but never he. Not even the first night he met her and paid for her services. "For my whore," he bellowed, and sprang upon the barricade. "For my pestilent whore! May she rot their souls in hell!" "For the whore!" cried the cataphracts. "For the whore!" The captured thunder flasks were hurled now, and hurled well. The iron elephant erupted in fire and flame. The cataphracts fired a volley, and another, and another. Again, as so often before, the Yeti had time to be astonished at the force of the ravening arrows as they ripped through the iron armor like so much cloth. Little time, little time. Few but cataphracts could draw those incredible bows. Those Yeti in the front ranks, those who survived, then had time to be further astonished. They had been awaiting a cavalry charge, fully confident that the dragon bolts would panic the great horses. Now they gaped to see the lancers advancing like infantry. In truth, the cataphracts were slower afoot than on saddle, but they were not much slower, so great was their bitter rage. And the lances which ruptured chests and spilled intestines onto the great thoroughfare were every bit as keen as Yeti memories recalled. "For the whore! For the whore!" The front line of the Yeti was nothing but a memory itself as the second line pressed forward, avid and eager to prove their mettle. Most of these, following Yeti custom, were inexperienced warriors, vainglorious in the heedless way of youth, who had never really believed the tales of the veterans. They came to believe quickly. Most died in the act of conversion, however, for the mace of a cataphract is an unforgiving instructor. Quick to find fault, quick to reprove, and altogether harsh in its correction. The second line, thus, was shredded almost instantly. The third line held for a time. It counted many veterans among its number, who had long since learned that cataphracts cannot be matched blow for blow. Some among them were able to take advantage of their great number to find the occasional gap in the armor, the rare opening for the well-thrust blade. But not many, and not for long. As wide as the Massey was, it was still a street hemmed by buildings. This was no great plain where the enemy could encircle their foe. As always, Belisarius had picked the ground for his defense perfectly. The Mahaveda, he had long known, relied too much on their numbers and their satanic weapons. But in that narrow place of death, closing immediately with their enemy so as to nullify the dragon weapons, advantage went to the cataphracts. This was partly due to the strength of the cataphracts, to the awesome iron power of their armored bodies. But mostly it was due to their steel-hard discipline. The Mahaveda had tried to copy that discipline in their own armies, but had never truly been able to do so. As ever, the Mahaveda relied on fear to enforce their will. But fear, in the end, can never duplicate pride. On that day of final fury, the cataphracts didn't forget their ancient discipline. That discipline had conquered half the world once and ruled it for a millennium. Ruled it not badly, moreover, all things considered. Well enough, at least, that over the centuries, people of many races had come to think themselves Roman and take pride in the name. On Rome's final day, in truth, there were few Latins in the ranks of the cataphracts, and none from the city which gave the empire its name. Greeks, in the main, from the sturdy yeomanry of Anatolia. But Armenians were there too, and Goths, and Huns, and Syrians, and Macedonians, and Thracians, and Illyrians, and Egyptians, and even three Jews, who quietly practiced their faith. Their comrades looked the other way and said nothing to the priests. Today the cataphracts would finally lose the world, after a war which had lasted decades, and would lose it to an enemy fouler than the Medusa. but they would not falter in their Roman duty and their Roman pride and their Roman discipline. The third line of Yetai collapsed and pushed the fourth back. Incredibly, to the Mahaveda priests who watched, standing atop the skin-bearing wagons with their Mahami Mamsa flares, the Byzantines were driving their way through the horde of Yetai, like a sword cutting through armor, piercing straight to... They shrieked then. Shrieked in outrage, partly, but mostly they shrieked in fear. The Rajputs, the priests knew, never called the great general of the enemy by his name. They called him simply the Mongoose. It was an impious habit, for which the priests had reproved them often. They would have done better to listen, they realize now, watching the fangs of Belisarius gape wide. "I see it worked," said Justinian. "As your stratagems usually do." The old emperor arose from his chair and shuffled forward laboriously. Belisarius began to prostrate himself, but Justinian stopped him with a gesture. "We don't have time." He cocked an ear, listening for a moment to the sounds of battle which carried faintly into the dim recesses of the Hagia Sophia. The emperor had chosen to meet his end here in the great cathedral which he had ordered built so long ago. Ever the soldier, Belisarius had argued for the great palace. That labyrinth of buildings and gardens would be far easier to defend. But, as so often before, the emperor had overruled him. For perhaps the only time, Justinian knew that he had been right to do so. The great palace was meaningless. The empire which had lasted a millennium would be finished by nightfall, never to return in all the countless years of the Gorgon future. But the soul was everlasting, and the emperor's only concern now was for eternity, to save his own soul, if possible, although he was not confident and rather thought hellfire awaited him, but at the least to do his best to save the souls of those who had served him for so long and so faithfully and so uncomplainingly and with so little reason to have done so. The eyes of the emperor gazed upon his general. The eyes were old and weak and weary and filled with pain both of the body and the spirit, that they had lost not a trace of their extraordinary intelligence, that great blinding intelligence, that intelligence which had been so great it had blinded the very man who possessed it. "It is I, in truth, who should prostrate myself to you," said Justinian. His voice was harsh. He had spoken the truth, and he knew it, and knew that his general knew it. But he found no liking for the truth. No, none at all. He never had. A figure advanced from the shadows. Belisarius had known he would be there, but hadn't seen him. The Maratha was capable of utter stillness and silence. "Let me clean them, master," said the slave, extending his arms. They were very old, those arms, but had lost little of their iron strength. Belisarius hesitated. "There is time," said the slave. "The cataphracts will hold the Asura's dogs long enough." He smiled faintly. "They do not fight for the empire now, not even for your god. They fight for your Christ and his Mary Magdalene, whom they betrayed often enough in life, but will not in death. They will hold long enough." He extended his arms in a forceful gesture. "I insist, master. It may mean little to you, but it does to me. I have a different faith, and I would not have these precious souls go unclean to their destiny." He took the horrid parcels from Belisarius's unresisting arms and carried them to a cistern. Into the water he thrust the skins and began cleaning them, gently, for all that he moved in haste. Emperor and general watched silently. It seemed fitting to both, each in their own way, that a slave should command at the end of all time. Soon enough the slave was done. He led the way through the cavernous darkness. The myriad candles which would normally have illuminated the wondrous mosaics of the cathedral were extinguished. Only in the room at the far recesses in the rear did a few tapers still burn. They were not needed, however. The great vat resting in the center, bubbling with molten gold and silver, was more than enough to light the room. Lighted almost like day, so fiercely did the precious metals blaze. Justinian pondered the vat. He had ordered it constructed many months ago, foreseeing this end. He was quite proud of the device, actually. As proud of it as he had been of the many other marvelous contrivances which adorned his palaces. Whatever else of his youth the Thracian peasant had lost in his bloody climb to the throne and his bloodier rule, he had never lost his simple childish delight in clever gadgets. Greek and Armenian craftsmen had constructed the device with their usual skill. Justinian reached out and pulled the lever which started the intricate timing device. In an hour, the vat would disgorge its contents. The accumulated treasure of Rome's millennium would pour out the bottom, down through the multitude of channels which would scatter it into the labyrinthine sewers of Constantinople. There, it would be buried for all time by the captured dragon flasks in their eruption. The Greeks had never learned the secret of the dragon weapons, but they knew how to use captured ones to good effect. In an hour, it would be done. But the vat had a more important use to which it would now be put. Nothing of Rome's greatness would be left to adorn the walls and rafters of the Malwa Palace. "Let us be done with it," commanded the emperor. He shuffled over to a bier and stooped. With difficulty, for he was weak with age, he withdrew its burden. The slave moved to assist him, but the emperor waved him back. "I will carry him myself." As always, his voice was harsh. But when the emperor gazed down upon the face of the mummy in his arms, his face grew soft. "In this one thing I was always true. In this, if nothing else." "Yes," said Belisarius. He looked down at the face of the mummy and thought the embalmers had done their work well. Long years had it been since the Empress Theodora had died of cancer, long years resting in her bier, but her waxen face still bore the beauty which had marked it in life. More so, perhaps, thought Belisarius. In death, Theodora's face showed peace and gentle repose. There was nothing in it now of the fierce ambition which had so often hardened it in life. Laboriously, the emperor took his place on the ledge adjoining the vat. Then he stepped back, not from fear, but simply from the heat. It couldn't be borne for more than a moment, and he still had words which had to be said. Had to be, not wanted to be. The emperor wished it were otherwise, for if ever had lived a man who begrudged apology, it was Justinian. Justinian the Great he had wanted to be called, and so remembered by all posterity. Instead, he would be known as Justinian the Fool. At best. Attila had been called the Scourge of God. He suspected he would be known as the Catastrophe of God. He opened his mouth to speak, clapped it shut. "There is no need, Justinian," said Belisarius, for the first and only time in his life calling the emperor by his simple name. "There is no need." An old familiar crooked smile. "And no time, for that matter. The last cataphract will be falling soon. It would take you hours to say what you're trying to say. It will not come easily to you, if at all." "Why did you never betray me?" whispered the emperor. "I repaid your loyalty with nothing but foul distrust." "I swore an oath." Disbelief came naturally to the emperor's face. "And look what it led to," he muttered. "You should have betrayed me. You should have murdered me and taken the throne yourself. For years now all Romans would have supported you, nobles and common alike. You were all that kept me in power since Theodora died." "I swore an oath. To God, not to Romans." The emperor gestured with his head at the faint sounds of battle. "And that? Does your oath to God encompass that? Had you been emperor instead of I, the Antichrist might not have triumphed." Belisarius shrugged. "Who is to know the future? Not I, my lord. Nor does it matter. Even had I known the course of the future, down to the last particular, I wouldn't have betrayed you. I swore an oath." Pain finally came to the emperor's face. "I do not understand." "I know, lord." The sounds of battle were faint now. Belisarius glanced at the entrance to the chamber. The slave stepped forward and handed him the skin of Sittus. Belisarius gazed upon the face of his friend, kissed it, and tossed it into the vat. A brief burst of flame and the trophy was lost to Satan. He gazed longer upon the face of his stepson, but not much before it followed into destruction. He knew Phocius would understand. He too had commanded armies and knew the value of time. Finally, he took the remains of Antonina into his arms and stepped upon the ledge. A moment later, Justinian joined him, bearing the mummy of the Empress. The slave thought it was fitting that the Emperor, who had always preceded his general in life, should precede him in death. So he pushed Justinian first. He had guessed the Emperor would scream at the end, but the old tyrant was made of sterner stuff. Sensing the approach of the slave behind him, Justinian had simply said, "Come, Belisarius, let us carry our whores to heaven. We may be denied entrance, but never they." Belisarius had said nothing, nor, of course, had he screamed. As he turned away from the vat, the old slave grinned. The general, for all the suppleness of his mind, had always been absurdly stiff-necked about his duty. The Christian faith forbade suicide, and so the slave had performed this last service. But it had been a pure formality. At the end, the slave knew, as soon as he felt the first touch of the powerful hands at his back, Belisarius had leapt. But he would be able to tell his god that he had been pushed. His god wouldn't believe him, of course. Even the Christian god wasn't that stupid. But the Christian god would accept the lie. And if not he, then certainly his son. Why should he not? The slave, all the duties of a long lifetime finally done, moved slowly over to the one chair in the chamber and took his seat. It was a marvelous chair, as was everything made for the emperor. He looked around the chamber, enjoying the beauty of the intricate mosaics, and thought it was a good place to die. Such a strange people, these Christians. The slave had lived among them for decades, but he had never been able to fathom them. They were so irrational and given to obsessiveness, yet he knew not ignoble. They, too, in their own superstitious way, accepted bhakti. And if their way of bhakti seemed often ridiculous to the slave, there was this much to be said for it. They had stood by their faith, most of them, and fought to the end for it. More than that, no reasonable man could ask. No reasonable god, so much was certain, and the slave's god was a reasonable being. Capricious, perhaps, and prone to whimsy, but always reasonable. Those people whom the slave had cast into the molten metal had nothing to fear from God, not even the emperor. True, the fierce old tyrant would spend many lifetimes shedding the weight of his folly. Many lifetimes, for he had committed a great sin. He had taken the phenomenal intelligence God gave him and used it to crush wisdom. Many lifetimes. As an insect, the slave thought, perhaps even as a worm. But for all the evil he had done, Justinian had not been a truly evil man. And so, the slave thought, the time would come when God would allow the emperor to return as a poor peasant again somewhere in the world. Perhaps then he would have learned a bit of wisdom. But perhaps not. Time was vast beyond human comprehension. And who was to know how long it might take a soul to find moksha? The old slave took out the dagger from his cloak. Belisarius had given that dagger to him many years before, on the day he told the slave he was manumitting him. The slave had refused the freedom. He had no use for it any longer, and he preferred to remain of service to the general. True, he no longer hoped by then that Belisarius was Kalkin. He had once. But as the years passed in the general's service, the slave had finally accepted the truth. Great was Belisarius, but merely human. He was not the 10th Avatara who was promised. The slave had bowed to the reality, sadly, knowing the world was thereby condemned to many more turns of the wheel under the claws of the great Asura who had seized it. But truth was what it was. His dharma still remained. Belisarius had not understood his refusal, not really, but he had acquiesced and kept the slave. Yet that same day he had pressed the dagger into the slave's hand, that the slave might know that the master could also refuse freedom. The slave had appreciated the gesture. Just so should mortals dance in the eyes of God. He weighed the weapon in his hand. It was an excellent dagger. In his day, the old slave had been a deadly assassin, among many other things. He had not used a dagger in decades, but he had not forgotten the feel of it. Warm and trusting, like a favorite pet. He lowered it. He would wait a while. All was silent beyond the walls of the Hagia Sophia. The cataphracts who had stood with Belisarius for one final battle were dead now. They had died well. Oh, very well. In his day, the old slave had been a feared and famous warrior, among many other things. He had not fought a battle in decades, but he knew the feel of them. A great battle they had waged, the cataphracts, all the greater that there had been no purpose in it save Dharma. And perhaps, the slave admitted, the small joy of a delicious revenge. But revenge would not weigh too heavily on their destiny, the slave thought. No, the cataphracts had shed much karma from their souls. The slave was glad of it. He had never cared much for the cataphracts, it was true. Crude and boastful they were. Coarse and unrefined compared to the kshatriya the slave had once been. But no kshatriya could ever claim more than the dead cataphracts outside the walls of the Hagia Sophia. Arjuna himself would adopt their souls and call them kinfolk. Again he thought about the dagger and knew that his own karma would be the better for its use. But again he thrust the thought aside. No, he would wait a while. It wasn't that he feared the sin of suicide. His faith didn't share the bizarre Christian notion that acts carried moral consequences separate from their purpose. No, it was that he, too, couldn't bear to leave this turn of eternity's wheel without a small, delicious revenge. The Asura's vermin would need time to find the chamber where the old slave sat. Time, while the Yetai dogs and their Rajput fleas slunk fearfully through the great cavern of the cathedral, dreading another strike of the mongoose. The old slave would give them the time. He would add considerable karma to his soul, he knew, but he couldn't resist. He would taunt the tormentors. So had Shakuntala taunted them so long ago before opening her veins. And now, at the end of his life, the old slave found great joy in the fact that he could finally remember the girl without pain. How he had loved the treasure of the world, that jewel of creation. From the first day her father had brought her to him and handed her into his safe keeping. "Teach her everything you know," the emperor of great Andhra had instructed. "Hold back nothing." 7 years old she had been. Dark skin for her mother was Carolyn. Her eyes, even then, had been the purest black beauty. As she aged, other men were drawn to the beauty of her body, but never the man who was years later to become the slave of Belisarius. He had loved the beauty of the girl herself, and he had taught her well, he thought, had held back nothing. He laughed then as he hadn't laughed in decades. At the sound of that laugh, the Yetai and Rajput warriors who were creeping beyond froze in their tracks, like paralyzed deer. But the sound of the slave's joy had rung the walls of the cathedral like the scream of a panther. And indeed, so had the slave been called in his own day. The panther of Maharashtra, the wind of the great country. Oh, how the wind had loved the Princess Shakuntala. The daughter of the great Andhra's loins, it might be. Who was to know? Paternity of the body was always a favorite subject of God's humor. Yet this much was certain. Her soul had truly been the cub of the panther. She alone of the Satavahana dynasty they had spared, the Asura's dogs, when they finally conquered Andhra. She alone for the beauty of her body. A prize which the Emperor Skandagupta would bestow on his faithful servant Venandakatra. Venandakatra the vile. The vermin of vermin was Venandakatra, for the Malwa Emperor himself was nothing but the Asura's beast. The panther had been unable to prevent her capture. He had lain hidden in the reeds, almost dead from the wounds of that last battle before the palace at Amaravati. But after he recovered, he had tracked the dogs back to their lair, north across the Vindhyas, to the very palace of the Vile One. Shakuntala was there. She had been in prison for months, held for Venandakatra's pleasure upon his return from the mission whence the emperor had sent him the year before, unharmed but safely guarded. The panther had studied the guards carefully and decided he couldn't overcome them. Kushans, under the command of a shrewd and canny veteran who took no chances and left no entry unguarded. The panther inquired. Among many other things, he had been a master spy in his time, and so he discovered much. But the outstanding fact discovered was that the Kushan commander was indeed not to be underestimated. Kungus, his name was, and it was a name the panther had heard. No, best abide his time. Then time had run out. Venandakatra had returned and had entered his new concubine's chamber at once, a horde of Yetai guards clustering outside. The Vile One was eager to taste the pleasure of her flesh and the greater pleasure of her defilement. Remembering that day, the old slave's sinewy fingers closed about the haft of the dagger, but he released his grip. He could hear the shuffling feet of the vermin beyond. He would bide a while. Not much longer now, he thought. Just long enough to torture the torturers. On the last day of the girl's life, the panther had knelt in the woods below Venandakatra's palace, knelt in fervent prayer, a prayer that Shakuntala would remember all that he had taught her, and not just those lessons which come easily to youth. The old slave had been a noted philosopher in his day, among many other things, and so long years before he had prayed that the treasure of his soul would remember that only the soul mattered in the end. All else was dross. But, as he had feared, she had not remembered. Everything else, but not that. And so, when he heard the Vile One's first scream, he had wept the most bitter tears of a bitter lifetime. Years later, he heard the tale from Kungus himself. Odd how time's wheel turns. He had met the one-time commander of Shakuntala's guard on the same slave ship which bore him to the market at Antioch. The panther had finally been captured in one of the last desperate struggles before all of India was brought beneath the Asura's talons. That his captors hadn't recognized the wind of the great country and their weary, much-scarred captive, and so they had simply sold him as a slave. Kungus, he discovered, had long been a slave. His hands were missing now, cut off by the Yetai guards who had blamed him for Shakuntala's deed. Cut off by the same guards who had shouldered him and his Kushans aside, avid to watch their master at his sport, and hopeful, of course, that the Vile One might invite them to mount the child after he had satiated himself. Kungus was missing his eyes and his nose as well, but the Mahami Mamsa had left him his ears and his mouth, so that he might hear the taunts of children and be able to wail in misery. But Kungus had always been a practical man, so he had taken up the trade of storytelling and mastered it, and if people thought the sight of him hideous, they bore it for the sake of his tales. Great tales, he told. None greater and more eagerly sought by the poor folk who were his normal clientele, though it was forbidden, than the tale of the Vile One's demise. Sitting in the hold of the slave ship, where he found himself, he explained cheerfully, because his fluent tongue had seduced a noble woman, but his sightless eyes hadn't spotted her husband's return, he told the tale to the panther. A gleeful tale, as Kungus told it, the more so because Kungus had come to accept that his own punishment was just. He had been responsible for the Vile One's demise, and had long since decided that it was perhaps the only pure deed of a generally misspent life. Kungus had always despised Venandakatra and the Yetai who lorded it over all but the Malwa, and in his hard and callous way he had grown fond of the princess. So he had not cautioned them. He had held his tongue. He had not warned them that the supple limbs of the girl's beauty came from the steel muscle beneath the comely flesh. He had watched her dance and knew. And knew also, watching the fluid grace of her movements, that she had been taught to dance by an assassin. Kungus had described the first blow, and the panther could see it even in the hold of the slave ship. The heel strike to the groin just as he had taught her, and all the blows which followed, like quick laughter, leaving the vile one writhing on the floor within seconds. Writhing, but not dead. No, the girl had remembered everything he taught her except what he had most hoped for. Certainly he knew, listening to the tale of Kungus, that she had remembered the assassin's creed when slaying the fowl, to leave the victim paralyzed but conscious, so that despair of the mind might multiply the agony of the body. Hearing the Asura's dogs finally enter the chamber, the old slave closed his eyes. Just a bit longer, just a bit, so that he could savor that moment in his mind's eye. Oh, how he had loved the black-eyed pearl of the Satavahana. He could see her dance now, the last dance of her life. Oh, great must have been her joy. To prance before the vile one, tantalizing him with the virgin body that would never be his. Not now. Not as Venon the Katra could watch his life pour out of his throat, slashed open by his own knife, bathing the bare quicksilver feet of his slayer as they danced the dance of death. Her own blood would join his soon enough, for she cut her own throat before the Yetai guards could reach her. But the vile one had found no pleasure in the fact, for his eyes were unseeing. It was time. Just as the Yetai reached out to seize him, the old slave leapt from the chair and sprang onto the rim of the flaming vat. The Yetai gaped to see an old man spring so like a young panther. Time to flay the flayers. Oh, well did he flay them, the slave, taunting them first with the bitterness of their eternally lost trophies. No skin or bone of great Romans would hang on the Malwa's walls. No Roman treasure fill its coffers. And then, with himself. Not once in the 30 years had the old slave used his true name, but he spoke it now and thundered it in the cathedral. Raghunath Rao is my name. I am he. I am the panther of Maharashtra. I slew your fathers by the thousands. I am the wind of the great country. I reap their souls like a scythe. I am the shield of the Deccan. My piss was their funeral pyre. Raghunath Rao am I. Raghunath Rao. The bane of false Gupta and the mirror of Rajputana's shame. Raghunath Rao. I am he. Well did they know that name, even after all these years, and they drew back, incredulous at first. But then, watching the old man dancing on the rim of gold fire, they knew he spoke the truth. For Raghunath Rao had been many things, and great in all of them, but greatest of all as a dancer. Great when he danced the death of Maharashtra's enemies, and great now when he danced the death of the great country itself. And finally, he flayed them with God. Oh, yes, the old slave had been a great dancer in his day, among many other things. And now, by the edge of Rome's molten treasure, in the thin smoke of Rome's molten glory, he danced the dance. The great dance. The terrible dance. The now forbidden but never forgotten dance. The dance of creation. The dance of destruction. The wheeling, whirling, dervish dance of time. As he danced, the Mahaveda priests hissed their futile fury. Futile because they didn't dare approach him, for they feared the terror in his soul. And the Yetai would not, for they feared the terror in his limbs. And the Rajputs could not, for they were on their knees weeping for Rajputana's honor. Yes, he had been a great dancer in his day, but never as great, he knew, as he was on this last day. And as he danced and whirled the turns of time, he forgot his enemies, for they were in the end nothing. He remembered only those he loved, and was astonished to see how many he had loved in his long and pain-filled life. He would see them again, perhaps, some day. When, no man could know, but see them he would, he thought. And perhaps in some other turn of the wheel he would watch the treasure of his soul dance her wedding dance, her bare quicksilver feet flashing in the wine of her beloved's heart. And perhaps in some other turn of the wheel he would see emperors bend intelligence to wisdom, and the faithful bend creed to devotion. And perhaps in some other turn of the wheel he would see Rajputana regain its honor, that his combat with the ancient enemy might again be a dance of glory. And perhaps in that other turn of the wheel he would find Khalkhin had come indeed, to slay the Asura's minions and bind the demon itself. What man can know? Finally, feeling his strength begin to fade, the old slave drew his dagger. There was no need for it, really, but he thought it fitting that such an excellent gift be used. So he opened his veins and incorporated the spurting blood into his dance, and watched his life hiss into the golden moltenness. Nothing of his, no skin nor bone, would he leave to the Asura. He would join the impure emperor and the pure general and the purest of wives. He made his last swirling, capering leap. Oh, so high was that leap. So high that he had time, before he plunged to his death, to cry out a great peal of laughter. O grim Belisarius, can you not see that God is a dancer? And creation his dance of joy.